She told me one time that she thought I was brainwashed. And I thought, yeah, I am brainwashed. Michael has washed my brain of all my own corrupt thoughts.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners, part two on cult leader Wayne Bent, aka Michael, a gaunt-looking man who looked older than his 66 years of age at the time that he appeared in a National Geographic documentary back in 2006. With a head of unkempt gray hair and a gray beard, this gaunt man was still a giant to his remaining followers, and still is to this day. Because, spoiler alert, he is still very much alive. There is still a compound, and many of the same people I saw in the documentary are the same people I encountered 16 years after it was filmed, and decades after he set up his stronghold in the most remote place I've ever been since moving to Southern Colorado. I mean, honestly, yesterday was a whirlwind, and I'm still slightly recovering from the mental and, well, also physical exhaustion, and you'll come to find out why, of climbing over a barbed wire fence to attempt to meet this man face to face. Yes, I may have trespassed, which I already apologized to the loyal female followers that hauntingly stopped me, got my information, and sent me a text about an hour later, which I'll post to the Seven Deadly Sinners podcast Instagram because it's eerie and interesting and it was all just very surreal. I mean, seeing this compound was surreal. And the fear I felt walking around there, like, God, are these the type of cult people that are like stockpiling weapons? Rachel, what the fuck are you doing? I'm also in tall grass and there's a lot of rattlesnakes in, you know, northern New Mexico, wherever we live. But I will say, these people were kind of peaceful, yet extremely guarded and extremely protective of their messiah.
I think I can knock on the door and be like, hey, I ran out of gas also.
I don't think you need to lie.
Then I'll just won't lie.
Oh, maybe. So see how they mowed right there? Maybe they're doing some walking.
Yeah. Just let me try, all right? What, are they going to shoot me and get charged for murder? Yeah, we're good. It is trespassing, I understand. Hopefully they're not looking.
Oh, I mean, I have to come with you if you gotta pick up.
Okay. I apologize for trespassing on the property, which are you of Wayne Bent?
Yeah.
I come in kindness.
Okay.
My name is Rachel.
Okay.
Well, I won't.
Well, I think our experience is that that doesn't work. Is that your cameraman or?
It's my husband, yeah. And yeah, it's my husband and yeah, it's not a camera. It's a sound thing.
Okay.
We have a podcast.
What's his name?
His name is Greg.
Okay, what's the last name?
O'Brien.
Okay.
Hey, don't worry, we're not gonna...
So what's your podcast?
And considering one of the women I met took down my name and number and podcast name, it's possible she and other current members may listen. And with that being said, I would like to publicly apologize if this is in any way offensive to her or the other members. My intent is not to harm you. In fact, my heart is with you. If you are unhappy in your current situation or are being coerced or controlled, but if you are happy and this is a solid choice made by you, then please just disregard my opinion on the matter. You're adults. If this is your choice, more power to you. You did seem calm and peaceful, And the thing I take issue with, which I said to your face, is when kids are involved. I'll just find it.
Reluctance to tell us that.
Seven deadly sinners.
Isn't very...
Seven deadly sinners.
So what I'm going to do is I will let him know that we talked. And you shouldn't trespass.
That's true.
That's not a good,
I agree.
Start.
Yeah, that's not a, not a good end. No, I get it.
Not a good start, and yeah. Probably wouldn't be a good end.
I'll be straight up honest with you. I do believe in God. I don't believe in a God that takes advantage of people, which I'm sure you've heard before, and I apologize if that's offensive.
Regardless, I respect you, and I am sorry again for coming onto your land. I am an idiot. Ambitious, but an idiot. And listen, I don't blame these people for falling for this man. He formed a cult probably without even knowing exactly what it was that he was forming. He made it up as he went along with his gluttonous desire to dominate.
I would have more authority to touch the soul than an MD would. MDs aren't prepared for what I've had to do. An MD is far more likely to think of sex when he's doing something to a woman in her private parts than I am.
Being in a cult is obviously the control of one person, eventually the group as a whole, over another. But it's also a dance of control within your own mind. You're constantly rationalizing the irrational, for fear that if you check back in with reality, you will find that you were conned. That months, years, sometimes decades of your life were a false reality created by a con artist. And even worse, confronting that, in some cases, that you brought your own young, impressionable child into something so sinister and set up for only one person's gain. It's gotta just be too much to bear. It's often said that when people leave cults, they say looking back that they left a fantasy world. And that reintegration back into society is not an easy road. Staying put in what you know might seem more comfortable, familiar. Leaving a cult can be like taking on the role of an actor in an unfamiliar world. In your previous world within the cult, you were told what to wear, what work to do. You didn't have your own money to spend. It was all communally given back to the leader. And then your basic needs, well, or not in some cases, were taken care of. Your sex and love life were determined by the leader, and were often with the leader. The cult were your friends, your family, your entire life. So reintegration back into society is understandably terrifying. You leave the familiar role you played in the cult for a world where there's no role defined for you. You have no idea how to socialize, how to date, how to apply for a job, interact in the workplace, how to be alone. And maybe the loneliness is the scariest part, when you are constantly surrounded by like-minded people living in a group mentality, living together. And on top of that, you're often alone dealing with the trauma of what went on in that cult, and to you. The isolation of being off the grid must be lonely, but you're with your family, quote-unquote, down there, at least in this case. And my God, was this place off the grid. Like 20 miles down a dirt road off the grid. Trailers and modular homes tucked against the small mountains. Thousands of acres before you even get to the homes. Surrounded by barbed wire, which now I have a battle scar from climbing over it. Again, ambitious, but an idiot. But it is strategically remote.
Here are some of the stories Jeff shared with us on the journey out there. Set the mood and the scene.
They tore down a house and it was like they found like 80 dead dogs in this house. Yeah. I guess they had some kind of business and they were taking care of their dogs. People would bring the dogs and then they would come back to retrieve them. They were dead. But they kept them. I don't know why they didn't bury them.
What the fuck?
I built that building right there.
Why were they dead?
Well, they just...
The people...
They died. There were so many of them.
What do you mean? That they just didn't take care of them?
It's really odd. I mean, it's one of them stories that you just don't understand.
What? Whoa!
They died in there, and they kept them in the house. That's the odd
thing. They didn't bury them, and they were living in the house?
Yeah, and then got the stink and everything, and finally...
Who are these people?
Well, they're gone. They fled. They left.
What's their names?
I don't know their names.
Were they they skinwalkers?
No. They were a young couple. They made national news.
I'm horrified. Folsom? Yeah.
Wow. No, Des Moines.
Des Moines? Okay. What?
And I was working right there, and I didn't...
Wow, I'm in a state of shock a little bit. That is...
Pretty weird shit, you know, pretty weird stuff.
Do you feel like more weird stuff happens because this is the middle of nowhere? New Mexico kind of is known for some weird shit. Yeah.
I wanted to see that microphone. You scare me now.
You're fine.
Now I'm not talking like a Tweety Bird like I always did.
What's that up there? The mounds of...
That's a Caliche. They're redoing this road. This Caliche road right here.
So this is Caliche?
Yeah.
I like Caliche. It's pretty and white. Is it better than Millings?
Better than mud.
Better than mud, yeah.
No, but we have Millings?
We have got asphalt Millings, yeah.
I was
working on it, so it'll get you further than anything in life. I believe that.
I agree with you. I'm pretty tough.
Say the good die young, you know, I'll live forever, I imagine.
Yeah. No, I think that you're just tough. I think you seem sweet as pie. Hey.
So this is Guy. This is what they call Guy.
So we're close now to
right
the...
Right over the hill.
Yeah, yeah. Because I mapped it out, and where Maddie put a pinpoint on the map, it seemed like Guy was the closest town. So is this an actual town, or is this a ghost town? Well, you know what I mean. Is there anything else?
Look, you see, looks good.
All right, there we go.
There's a snake in the house somewhere.
Snake den?
Yeah, there's a lot of snakes up there in the house.
Why?
I don't know, but there's the snakes just kind of, I guess they moved in and started.
Hey.
Yeah.
Rattlers?
God, this is remote, though. 2,000 acres.
I'm pretty sure that's about what they had.
They made a point to just be in the middle of nowhere.
Well, it's probably what ranch was for sale out here, you know?
They don't, yeah, they don't... but also if you want to, like, do some pretty illegal things to kids and people, get off the grid, right? Can we go up to the house?
We'll try. Well, they just house leaves, all they do.
Does he remember you, do you think?
Oh, no, hell no, no, no. It's been 17 years
ago. Okay, what's this say? Hold on.
That's probably...
No trespassing. Okay, so it's getting up to
but
the...
But I think there's a couple ways to get in there, though.
But going back to leaving a cult, personally, I feel there needs to be more resources out there for people trying to leave or support when they do. It's almost like leaving prison for decades. Oh, and all of a sudden there's cell phones and social media, self-driving cars, and your own personal autonomy for the first time in forever. So with all that said, let's have compassion for the people still remaining in this cult, and the ones who undoubtedly regret bringing their children in. Some children, as we will find out, refuse to leave.
I think I really feel a lot relief that it's the end.
Yeah. It's like that's what Father's saying now, just a little bit longer and you're gonna come home,
mm-hmm.
where you were meant to be.
Yeah.
It's like we weren't made to live on this earth away from Father. It's just gonna be awesome. We leave this world behind.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It will end, and so we have our heart set on that, on the promise that we were given, that this will happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's recap a bit of last week, though. Wayne Bent, aka Michael, is a man so gluttonous in the pursuit of his personal desires that he would even be able to master convincing his own son that God came down and commanded him to sleep with his son's wife, his daughter-in-law. God made him do that. And that's where we left off last week, and here's a little repulsive refresher. This is the clip we aired of him justifying it to the National Geographic cameras.
God came down on Michael and forced him to consummate with Christiana. I mean, it was a terrible, strange act of God. I was astonished, and so was Michael.
I was forced down on the floor, and I had to get down. I was down just about like this. and I was in pain, and all I could do was groan. All I could do was kind of rock. And I started seeing that the consummation with Christiana was imminent, and I was going to be, I was going to have to do that.
I mean, this dude is just laughable. But his stupidity doesn't end there. This documentary would be what would help land this man in prison. And if you weren't disgusted by that clip, you are in for a world of confusion and anger in this episode. And trigger warning, this episode deals with grooming, the sexual abuse of minors, coercive control, brainwashing, and just overall the worst of humanity all wrapped up in one extremely unimpressive man, Wayne Bent. Sources for this episode are the brilliant series of documentaries for National Geographic by Ben Anthony, who is the director and cinematographer, and who was admitted to the group's compound and was invited to interview both leaders and followers, which is really cool. Then there's also a New York Times article by Neil Genslinger, an ABC News article by Jen Pereira, and I think I'm saying it wrong, Peria, Kieran Khalid and Stephanie Dale, and my own in-person interviews with residents of the town and witnesses to the cult's bizarre activity and more. So upon secluding himself and his followers, who he calls witnesses, in rural New Mexico, Michael wasted no time in grooming his followers to fulfill his insatiable sexual void. The two women and their husbands and children, who were his first followers to join him in New Mexico, were unwaveringly faithful. One of those women was the first to begin a sexual relationship with Michael, an act that no one argued with, well, except her son. When Michael eventually goes on trial for his crimes, a man named Seth, who was brought into the cult by his parents when he was a kid, shows up to reunite with his parents, but also to make sure Michael gets the justice he deserves. When Seth entered the cult, he was obviously obligated as a child to go along with his parents' new religion. But Seth hit his breaking point when at 16, his mom came to him, sat him down, and said that God had commanded her and Michael to consummate their relationship while still married to Seth's father. And his father was very distraught by this. But similarly to Michael's son, Jeff, his father claimed that he understood it was God's will. It was very strange, but it had to be done.
It was a battle between me and God. And it's like Michael was on my side. He said, if you're angry at God, go tell him. Michael was my way through it.
It seems Seth was the only one appalled by this. So appalled that at 16 years old, he packed up and ran away across the country to Florida, only leaving his mom a note. In the documentary, his mother is one of the two original women that were in the cult. And I can't quite figure out how to describe this, but Michael's being filmed, talking for the documentary, sitting in a chair, kind of almost like, it looks like a throne, even though it's just a regular chair, but the way the women are placed on each side of him, on the ground, they're kind of perched on their knees, almost like if you saw an Egyptian painting of a pharaoh. Weird, I've had to mention pharaoh vibe twice recently with cult leaders. But it's like a picture of a pharaoh sitting on a throne, and then two people that are perched on their knees, almost like dogs. And I'm not trying to disrespect them by saying this. I just don't know how else to describe it. Just staring in awe, just awestruck with him when he speaks, and their eyes are as wide as saucers. I got to tell you, Ben Anthony, who did this documentary, does an incredible job of catching the nuances of this cult. And in this instance, he zooms in at one point on one of the women's eyes, not blinking, huge, staring in awe of Michael. It is very, very unsettling. And again, I'm not making fun of her. She's clearly brainwashed. It's just very unsettling. So Seth's mom is one of those women. And Seth shows up at the trial years later in an attempt to see the family he left behind and to see the justice of Wayne Bent through. A few years into moving the cult to New Mexico and growing his following to about 50 people, Wayne had already had sex with 7 members of the cult. The only other person to openly question the Messiah was immediately sent off the compound. This man, Tim, questioned Wayne when he anointed himself the title of Messiah, and the sexual coercion began. Wayne even asked Tim what he thought, and the man said to Wayne's face, "You've gone too far." To which Wayne responded, quote, "I want you off the property today." What Wayne didn't know is that this man had already started packing. Tim was seeing families being broken up, and Wayne's lust for power was growing. And Tim tried to convince his wife that was the love of his life, and still is, he talks about it on the documentary after they broke up, to come with him. But she was in too deep, gripped in the clutches of Wayne, and she refused to leave. With nothing left to do, Tim left the cult. And his wife, who he was brokenhearted to have chosen the cult over him, eventually also chose Wayne. She began a sexual relationship with Wayne shortly thereafter. What's crazy in all of this is I still don't even know what his teachings are. It really seems this has less to do about religion and more about Wayne Bent's desires. Another character we meet in this documentary is a woman named Prudence. If you remember from last week, our cult tour guide of sorts, Jeff, who joins us again this week, had a crazy story of what seems to be a recruitment tactic by a former member. Prudence, who eventually also was a whistleblower when she left the cult. It's a crazy story, but listen, before you hear it, I want you to know I believe it's possible she was just trying to help her friend out. Not necessarily trying to recruit new members, but I don't know. I'll let Jeff tell the story.
Well, I don't know. Well, so she knew, she was kind of pretty computer savvy back then, where I wasn't, you know. So I went on a cruise to Cozumel, Mexico with some college buddies, and I met this girl named Nicole from Houston. And I, you know, when we left, when we get off the ship, they kind of herd you out there like cattle, you know. They want you off and a whole other set of people in. So I lost track of her, but somehow, I gave Prudence her name or something, and Prudence had been talking to her on the computer, where I had no idea, yeah. She said, "You got to go pick up Nicole and Amarillo off at the airport on the 4th of July." I'm like, "For what? What are you talking about?" She said, "Well, I've been talking to her, acting as me."
As you?
As, yeah.
Without
as,
you asking?
Without me even knowing. I had no idea. I'm like, "What am I supposed to go pick her up for?" He's like, "Well, she's coming to see you." And I was like, "Well, cool, whatever." Then I had to go buy new furniture down there and, you know, kind of fix up the house, not make it look like a bastard so much. So I go pick her up. And
do you think she was trying to recruit her to the cult, like to bring her here?
You know, I have no idea, because I don't, because she didn't even know who Prudence was. When I did make the comment, I was like, "You know, you probably ought to just go straight to Prudence's house, because that's who you've been talking to. You know, really not me."
You have no idea how bizarre that story is. Like, that was so culty.
Well,
like,
I thought it was kind of weird. I'm like, "You've been, what, I got to go pick up who?" You know, she's like, "Yeah, go pick up Nicole." And I was like, "Cool, what are you?" Because I hadn't seen her, and I wasn't talking to her all the time. You know, I was like, "All right."
Did she just no problem. Have any of your stuff, or had you said to
Prudence, I must have given her,
"I'm hanging out with this girl named Nicole"?
No, I must have given her, somehow she was able to get a hold of her, and I really can't remember how. You know, but she cleaned my house, for God's sake. You know, she could get anything. You know, I was gone, you know, when she was there, you know.
So what happened then after you picked her up?
Well, Nicole was scared to death, because I pick her up in a pickup, you know, and I got 2250 up on the roof of the, you know, strapped up to the roof of the pickup, and I'm going 80 miles an hour down these Caliche roads. My nearest neighbor's 8 miles away. It's 18 miles down the road where I live. And she's like, "You live out here?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she was totally freaked out. I didn't really kind of realize it till after, but she was scared to death, like I was going to take her out there to kill her or something. She was born and raised on cement, you know. She had no idea that people would live out in the country, you know, right?
Prudence also appears in the documentary, showing up at the trial to try and see her parents, who are still in the cult, just to tell them that she loved them and she wasn't taking sides. She just wanted to see them. You see, the members that have left are seen as the devil's servants by members still within the cult, an idea implanted in their brains by their leader, Wayne.
I told him, I said, you're not my brother. You're not like my brother. He was dark inside and kind of cold. I mean, it's like hugging the devil. It'll be okay. Be good.
And this notion of good versus evil is prevalent throughout this cult's history. Members are made to feel they are evil without Wayne. He is the only path to being good. So think about trying to leave and how you'd probably never be able to shake the shame and mark that you're evil, even on the outside. It has to stay with you in some respect. So as a slightly more mild example, I have family members that grew up Catholic that don't really practice but still consider themselves Catholic. Same with Greg. He was raised Catholic. And I think that Catholic guilt is something that sticks with you. Even if you're not actively going to church every Sunday, Catholic guilt is a thing. And Wayne's son Jeff has to have the feeling of always being evil tug at his psyche because his dad implanted that in him. And this is how Jeff describes it in the documentary, which is just heartbreaking.
Well, it's a great honor to be closely associated, that closely associated with Messiah, and to be somebody that he would count as one of his most intimate associates. It's proof that God doesn't pick good people. He just picks whoever's willing.
Are you not a good person?
I'm not a good person, no. I'm very evil.
And then, even worse than an adult man feeling this way, a literal child who was brought into the cult as a baby and would be one of the two sisters that Wayne's trial would rest on their stories of abuse. However, the teenage girl is so programmed in that documentary that when asked if she feels brainwashed while sitting next to old man Rickety Fuckface, who's smiling smug into the camera next to her, she says this.
She told me one time that she thought I was brainwashed. And I thought, yeah, I am brainwashed. Michael has washed my brain of all my own corrupt thoughts.
Here is Lakeisha's story. Her parents, John and Elsa Sayer, brought her into the apocalyptic cult. Yes, their Messiah predicted the world would end on October 31st, 2007. And right in front of documentary cameras, a bizarre-sounding horn blared through speakers coming from Wayne's house throughout the compound. Gathered together and watched as midnight came and went, and nothing changed. Yet still so strongly in Wayne's grasp, they chanted and celebrated as if something had happened, and then woke up the next day, returning to cult life as they knew it. Lakeisha was one of the most stringent followers, again a literal baby when she was brought in by her parents, who eventually, after 16 years of following Wayne, became disillusioned and concerned. Things were already showing up as red flags for the parents when the communal Christ life thing they had intended to join rapidly declined after Wayne declared himself the Messiah and began sleeping with other men's wives. But the tipping point was when they discovered their two teenage daughters, Ashley and Lakeisha, had lain naked with their leader, an elderly man, skin to skin, in his bed. An act he claimed was a show of healing. An act he allowed cameras to document. One of the first young girls, the oldest of the teens, to say straight to the camera this.
Literally, physically naked. And it was in me that it meant with Michael. So I said, well, Michael, I said, I've been having this thought that I just needed to come up here and take off all my clothes. Really. And he looks at me and he kind of smiles. So I said, well, I said, shall I? And he thought for just a minute. He was quiet. And, you know, I know he was listening for Father's instructions. And he said, you may. And so I did. And then he said he would hold me. And I hadn't even thought of that. It was just that wasn't, it hadn't even crossed my mind. But
you just knew you need to get naked with
yeah,
him.
Yeah, I just knew that this needed to be literally physically naked. Mm-hmm. And so he went to the bedroom and laid down and he held me, and somehow it was like all of heaven was open to me. Somehow I started to see God. Well, somehow, as the Son of God holding me.
Yeah.
And so I'm laying there and I was like, for the first time, I was like, God loves me. Mm-hmm. He loves me.
But that desire or coercion laid out by Wayne seemed to spread like wildfire amongst the teen girls. Feeling they needed to lie naked with Wayne, that they would do anything to do so. And Lakeisha was one of them. And though Lakeisha testified at his trial, along with her sister Ashley, it seemed Lakeisha was so brainwashed, she was more there in his defense than in his opposition. Unwilling to, and probably never got the proper therapy to realize that she was sexually abused by her leader. Here is Lakeisha again.
We began talking about my day. And then I said, well, I actually came to tell you, and then I shared with him what was on my heart. I told him that it was strongly on my heart to lay naked with him, and that I wanted it to be skin to skin. I told him I want something deeper. I want something. Michael was quiet for a little while, and then he said, "You may." And then he asked me, are you afraid? And all of a sudden I realized he really meant it. And I excitedly told him, you mean right now? And take my clothes off and get in bed with you? And he said, yes. And so I asked him, I said, but what about my parents? And he told me, well, they said that they trusted me.
Her childlike voice and enthusiasm for her leader make me feel so sad to hear. I mean, she's supposed to be there to put this man in prison, but it seems that she's trying to keep him out. Her childhood indoctrination and brainwashing are just so strong. She describes the encounter laying naked in bed with Wayne in the same childlike voice and enthusiasm, and then she also states that Wayne never sexually touched her breasts, but they did press chest to chest together. And then later, when asked at the trial how she felt in that moment, she starts to cry. And at first, listening to it, when she begins to cry, I anticipated far different words coming from her mouth than the ones she actually said. Here's a clip of that, and it is very hard to listen to.
Did you ever tell anybody that
he put his chest on your chest?
Yes.
And did that happen?
He did put his chest on me, but he did not put it on directly on my breast.
Why do you give us that clarification?
I don't remember Michael ever touching my breasts. And this is one reason why I know he didn't lay on his chest directly on me. And I love Michael.
Your Honor, the state would request a 5-minute recess.
We will be in recess for 5 minutes.
On contrast, her sister Ashley tells the story of a girl who did not want to be there. Though I know in my heart of hearts, neither did Lakeisha, had she not been so groomed. I mean, I think that's obvious that a child cannot make those type of adult decisions. I really hate this man.
Did he go with you into the bedroom?
Yes.
Do you remember a little bit about what you might have said?
I was nervous.
Did you tell Michael you were nervous?
Yes.
Okay. And Ashley, why were you nervous?
Because I was scared.
Okay. When you were in Michael's bedroom, did he kiss you?
Yes.
Did he kiss you on the lips?
Yes.
Did he kiss you anywhere else?
Yes.
And I know it's difficult. Where did he kiss you?
On the breast.
Can you tell us where, what physical part of your body he put his hand on?
Over the heart.
And when he had his hand over your
heart. This trial was preceded by a fairly dramatic arrest. As it seemed, besides the possible mass suicide rumor, the cult wasn't the type to be stockpiling weapons and running military drills. When Wayne Bent was arrested, helicopters buzzed above the remote compound. Armed officers cut the locks on the gate. They took him into custody at the protest of his followers, a protest so strong that one follower almost died after fasting for 30 days in support of her leader. Yet, Wayne Bent went to prison for 8 years on the counts of,
you find the defendant Wayne Bent guilty of criminal sexual contact of a minor as charged in count 2. You find the defendant Wayne Bent guilty of contributing to the delinquency of a minor as charged in count 3. You find the defendant Wayne Bent guilty of contributing to the delinquency of a minor as charged in count 4.
He's back on the compound, and the remaining followers will do anything to protect him, which I saw firsthand. It's crazy to see that the people I saw in the documentary from nearly 20 years ago are still there. My only worry, and I'm not the only one concerned with this, as law enforcement took notice back in June 2022, when Wayne Bent posted to his website a video over an hour and a half long of insane ramblings and blaming of others titled Messiah's Last Words. He's 82 and he's on his way out. I just hope that his followers don't go with him. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review. And I'll see you next week for spooky season.